Whoever he was, he remained free and hidden, perhaps still safe within the city. If he learned the exact details of the evacuation plan, he would undoubtedly attempt to warn the Northlanders. Secrecy was absolutely necessary if this dangerous venture was to be successful. The remainder of the day passed quickly for Menyon. Forgotten for the moment were Shea and his companions of the past few weeks. For the first time since Shea had come to him in the Highlands, the Prince of Lee was faced with a problem that he fully understood, requiring skills he knew how to employ. The enemy was no longer the Skull King or the spirit creatures that served him. The enemy was flesh and blood, creatures that lived and died according to the same rules as other men, and their threat was one the Highlander could appreciate and analyze. Time was the greatest single factor in his plan to outwit the waiting army, and so he threw himself into the most important undertaking of his life, the saving of an entire city. Together with the members of the council, he directed the building of the giant wooden rafts which would be utilized to convey the majority of the besieged citizens of Kern down the still-flooded Myrmidon to the safety of Tirsis. The point of embarkation was to be the southwest coastline immediately below the city proper. There was a broad but well-concealed inlet from which the rafts and smaller boats would be launched under cover of darkness. Directly across the river from the inlet stood a series of low bluffs that ran to the edge of the embankment. Menyon thought that a handful of men could ford the river when the main attack on the enemy encampment began later that night. Once across, they could subdue the small guard post that would be keeping watch. After the sentries were dispatched, the boats and rafts would be launched, flowing downriver with the current, following the south branch of the Myrmidon to Tirsis. There was nothing to assure them that the vessels would not be spotted instantly, but it was the only possible course of action. Menyon believed that if the sky remained clouded, the sentry commands were withdrawn upriver to defend against the fake assault on the main encampment, and the people of the city kept silent on the rafts, then the evacuation might be successful. But toward late afternoon, the rain started to slacken off altogether, and the clouds began to thin out, permitting small strips of blue to seep through the rolling grayness. The storm was drawing to an end, and it appeared the night sky would be cloudless and the land exposed to the revealing light of the new moon and 1,000 winking stars. Menyon was seated in one of the smaller rooms of the council hall when he saw these first signs of a clearing, his attention momentarily diverted from the huge map spread out on the table before him. At his side were two members of the disbanded Border Legion, Jonas Senpre, the lieutenant commander of the Legion and the highest-ranking officer on the island, and a grizzled veteran named Fandres. The latter knew the country around Kern better than anyone and had been called in to advise the attack squad in its strike against the giant Northland army. Senpre, his superior, was surprisingly young for his rank, but a sharp and determined soldier with 12 years of field duty already behind him. He was a devoted follower of Balinor, and like Menyon, he was considerably upset to learn that nothing had been heard from Tirsis concerning the prince's arrival. Earlier that afternoon, he had selected 200 seasoned soldiers from the disbanded Border Legion to form the strike force that would be directed against the enemy camp. Menyon had offered his aid, and it had been eagerly accepted. The Highlander was still cut and bruised about the feet and lower legs from his arduous flight after rescuing Shurl Ravenlock, but he refused to stay behind with the evacuation party when the feint by the small attack squad had been his idea. Flick would have written off his insistence as a foolish mixture of stubbornness and pride, but Menyon Lee would not be left in comparative safety on the island while a battle was being fought across the river. It had taken him years to find something worthwhile to fight for, something more than personal satisfaction and the irresistible lure of one more adventure. He was not about to be a passive spectator while the most awesome threat in centuries decimated the race of man. This point, over here by the spin bar, that's the landing point to take, the slow, grating voice of Fandres cut into his thoughts, drawing his attention back to the carefully detailed map. Jonas Senpre agreed, looking at Menyon to be certain he was taking careful note. The Highlander nodded quickly. They will have sentries posted all along that grassland just above the bar, he said in reply. If we don't dispose of them immediately, they could cut off any retreat. Your job will be to keep them out of there. Keep the way open, the Legion commander stated. Menyon opened his mouth in objection, but was cut short. I appreciate your desire to come with us, Menyon, but we still have to move much faster than the enemy, and your feet are in poor condition for any prolonged running. You know that as well as I. So the shore patrol is yours. Keep our path to the boats open, and you will be doing us a much greater service than by coming with us. Menyon quietly nodded his agreement, though he was keenly disappointed. He had wanted to be in the forefront of the assault. Deep in the back of his mind, he still maintained hope of finding Shay a prisoner in the enemy camp. His thoughts drifted to Alanon and Flick. Perhaps they had found the missing Veilman, as the druid had promised they would try to do. He shook his head sadly. Shay. Shay, why did it have to be someone like you? Someone who just wanted to be left alone. There was a madness in the scheme of life that men were forced to accept, either with resigned fury or blunt indifference. There could be no final resolution, except, perhaps, in death. The meeting ended shortly thereafter, and a despondent and bitter Menyon Lee wandered aimlessly out of the council chamber, still lost in thought. Almost without realizing it, he walked down the stone stairway of the huge building to the street, and from there made his way back toward Shurl's home, keeping close to the covered walks and building walls. Where was it all leading? The threat of the warlock lord loomed before them like a towering, unscalable wall. How could they possibly hope to defeat a creature that had no soul? A creature that lived according to laws of nature completely foreign to the world into which they had been born. Why should a simple young man from an obscure hamlet be the only mortal entity with the ability to destroy such an indescribably powerful being? Menyon desperately needed to understand something of what was happening to him and to his absent friends, even if it was only one small piece in a thousand comprising the puzzle of the warlock lord and the sword of Shannara. Suddenly he found himself in front of the Ravenlock home, the heavy doors standing closed, their metal latches looking cold and frosted in the graying mist that hung in wisps with the cooling of the late afternoon air. He turned quickly from the entryway, not wishing to go in or to be with people for the moment, but preferring the solitude of the empty veranda. Slowly he moved along its stone path into the little garden at the side of the house, the leaves and flowers dripping softly with the rain of several days, the grounds beyond damp and green. He stood quietly, his own thoughts as hazy and wistful as the setting in which he paused, giving way for one brief moment to the sinking despair that seized him when he thought of how much he had lost. He had never felt alone like this before, even in the dark emptiness of the Highlands of Lee when he had hunted far from his own home and friends. Something deep within hinted with dread persistence that he would never go back to what had been, that he would never go back to his friends, his home, his old life. Somewhere in the days behind, he had lost it all. He shook his head, the unwanted tears building on the edge of his lids as the dampness closed in about him and the chill of the rain slipped deep into his chest. There were sudden footsteps on the stone behind him, and a small, lithe form came to a silent halt at his elbow, the rust-red locks shadowing wide eyes that looked up at him momentarily, and then strayed to the garden beyond. The two stood without speaking for a long time, the rest of the world shut away. In the sky above, heavy clouds were rolling in, covering the last faint traces of blue as the darkness of early twilight began to deepen. Rain was falling again in steady sheets on the besieged land of Calahorn, and Menyon noted with absent relief that it would be a black and moonless night on the island of Kern. It was well after midnight, the rain still falling in a soggy drizzle, the night sky still impenetrably black and ominous, when an exhausted Menyon Lee stumbled heavily onto a small, crudely constructed raft moored in a peaceful inlet on the southwestern coast of the island. Two slim arms reached out to catch him as he collapsed, and he stared wonderingly into the dark eyes of Cheryl Ravenlock. She had waited for him as she said she would, even though he had begged her to go with the others when the mass evacuation began. Cut and bruised, his clothing torn and his skin wet from the rain and his own blood, he let her wrap him in a cloak still somehow dry and warm, and pull him against her shoulder as they crouched in the night shadows and waited. There had been some who had returned with Menyon, and a few more who boarded now, all battle-weary, but fiercely proud of the courage and sacrifice they had displayed that night on the plains north of Kern. Never had the Prince of Lee seen such bravery in the face of such impossible odds. Those few men of the fabled Border Legion had so utterly disrupted the enemy camp that even now, some 4 hours after the initial strike, the confusion was still continuing. The enemy numbers had been unbelievable. Thousands after thousands milling about, striking out at anyone within reach, inflicting injury and death upon even their own companions. They had been driven by more than mortal fear or hatred. They had been driven by the inhuman power of the Warlock Lord, his incredible fury thrusting them into battle like crazed beings with no purpose but to destroy. Yet the men of the Legion had held them at bay, repeatedly thrown back only to regroup and strike once more. Many had died. Menyon did not know what had preserved his own meager life, but it bordered on a miracle. The mooring ropes were loosened, and he felt the raft begin to drift away from the shore, the current catching it and pulling it into the center of the flooded Myrmidon. Moments later, they were in the main channel, moving silently downriver toward the walled city of Tersus, where the people of Kern had fled several hours earlier in a perfectly executed mass evacuation. 40,000 people, huddled on giant rafts, small boats, even two-man dinghies, had slipped undetected from the besieged city as the enemy sentry posts guarding the western bank of the Myrmidon hastily returned to the main encampment, where it appeared a full-scale attack by the armies of Calahorn was in progress. The beating of the rain, the rushing of the river, and the cries of the distant camp had blotted out the muffled sounds of the people on the rafts and boats, crowded and jammed together in a desperate, fearful bid for freedom. The darkness of the clouded sky had hidden them well, and their collective courage had sustained them. For the time being, at least, they had eluded the Warlock Lord. Menyon dozed off for a time, aware of nothing but a gentle rocking sensation as the river bore the raft steadily southward. Strange dreams flashed through his restless mind as time drifted away in long moments of peaceful silence. Then voices reached through to him, jostling his subconscious, forcing him to wake abruptly, and his eyes were seared by a vast red glare that filled the damp air about him. Squinting sharply, he raised himself from Cheryl's arms, uncertainty registering on his lean face as he saw the northern sky filled with a reddish glow that matched the brightness of the dawn's gold. Cheryl was speaking softly in his ear, the words faint and poignant.
"They have burned the city, Menyon. They have burned my home."
Menyon lowered his eyes and gripped the girl's slim arm with one hand. Though its people had been able to escape, the city of Kern had seen the end of its days, and with terrible grandness was passing into ashes. Chapter 25. The hours slipped silently away in the entombed blackness of the little cell. Even after the eyes of the captives had grown used to the impenetrable dark, there remained a solitude that numbed the senses and destroyed their ability to discern the passage of time. Beyond the empty darkness of the room and their own muffled breathing, the three captives could hear nothing save the infrequent scurrying of a small rodent and the steady drip of icy water on worn stone. Finally, their own ears began to lie to them, to hear sounds where there was only silence. Their own movement was meaningless because they could expect it, identify it, and dismiss it as insignificant and hopeless. An interminable length of time lingered and faded, and still no one came. Somewhere in the light and air above, amid the sounds of the people and the city, Palance Buckhanna was deciding their fate and, indirectly, the fate of the Southland. Time was running out for the land of Callahorn. The warlock lord moved closer with each passing hour. But here, in the silent blackness of this small prison, in a world shut away from the pulse beat of the human world, time had no meaning, and tomorrow would be the same as today. Eventually they would be discovered, but would they emerge again into the sun's friendly light, or would it be a transfer from one darkness into yet another? Would they find only the terrible gloom of the Skull King, his power extended not only into Callahorn, but into the farthest reaches of all the provinces of the Southland? Balinor and the Elven brothers had freed themselves within a short time after their captors had departed. The ropes binding them had not been secured with the intention of preventing any chance of escape once they were safely locked within that dungeon room, and the three had lost no time in working the knots loose. Huddled together in the darkness, the ropes and blindfolds cast aside, they discussed what would become of them. The dank, rotting smell of the ancient cellar almost stifled their breathing as they crouched close to one another, and the air was chill and biting even through their heavy cloaks. The floor was earthen, the walls stone and iron, the room barren and empty. Balinor was familiar with the cellar beneath the palace, but he did not recognize the room in which they had been imprisoned. The cellar was used primarily for storage, and while there had always been a number of walled rooms in which wine barrels had been placed to age, this was not one of them. Then, with chilling certainty, he realized that they had been imprisoned in the ancient dungeon constructed centuries ago beneath the cellar and later sealed off and forgotten. Palance must have discovered its existence and reopened the cells for his own use. Quite probably he had imprisoned Balinor's friends somewhere in this maze when they had come to the palace to object to the disbanding of the Border Legion. It was a well-concealed prison, and Balinor doubted that anyone searching for them would ever find it. The discussion was completed quickly. There was little to say. Balinor had left his instructions with Captain Shelon. Should they fail to return, he was to seek out Jinison and Fandwick, two of Balinor's most dependable commanders, and order them to reassemble the Border Legion to defend against any assault by the Warlock Lord and his invading army. Shelon had also been told to send word to the Elf and Dwarf nations, warning them of the situation and calling for their immediate support. Eventine would not permit his cousins to remain the prisoners of Callahorn for very long, and Al-Anon would come as soon as he heard of their misfortune. 4 hours must have passed long ago, he thought, so it should only be a matter of time. But time was precious, and with Palance determined to gain the throne of Calahorn, their own lives were in grave danger. The borderman began to wish silently that he had listened to Durin's advice and avoided a confrontation with his brother until he had been certain of the outcome. He had never imagined that matters would go this far awry. Palance had been like a wild man, his hatred so consuming that he had not even waited to hear what Balinor would say. Yet there was little mystery to this irrational behavior. It was more than personal differences between the two brothers that had prompted the youth's savage action. It was more than the illness of his father, an illness Palance somehow believed his brother was responsible for. It had something to do with Shirl Ravenlock, the alluring woman Palance had fallen in love with months before and had vowed to marry despite her own reticence toward the match. Something had happened to the young Kern girl, and Balinor had received the blame. Palance would do anything to get her back safely, if she was indeed missing, as his brother's few words immediately before they had been brought to this dungeon had indicated. The borderman explained the situation to the elven brothers. He felt certain Palance would come to them soon and demand information concerning the young woman. But he would not believe them when they said they knew nothing. More than 24 hours passed, and still no one came. There was nothing to eat. Even after their eyes gradually grew accustomed to the blackness, there was nothing to view but their own shadowy forms and the walls about them. They took turns sleeping, trying to conserve their strength for whatever lay ahead, but the abnormal silence prevented any real sleep, and they resigned themselves to a light, restless slumber that did little to refresh their bodies or their spirits. At first they attempted to find a weak spot on the hinges of the bulky iron door, but it was securely fastened in place. Without tools of any sort, they found it impossible to dig very far into the chill, iron-hard surface of the dirt flooring. The stone walls were aged, but still firm and solid, without any sign of a weak or crumbling layer in the mortar. Eventually they abandoned their attempts to escape, and sat back in silence. Finally, after endless hours of waiting in the chill darkness, they heard the distant sound of clanging metal as an ancient iron door somewhere above swung ponderously open. There were voices, muffled and soft, and then footsteps on stone as someone began to descend the worn stairs to the lower dungeon where the three were imprisoned. Quickly they rose to their feet and crowded close to the cell door, listening expectantly as the footsteps and the voices drew closer. Balinor could distinguish the voice of his brother above the rest, strangely hesitant and broken. Then the heavy latches were drawn back, the sudden grating of metal piercing to the ears of the three captives, who had become accustomed now to the death-like silence of their prison. And they moved back from the massive cell door as it swung slowly inward. Blazing streaks of torchlight flashed into the darkened room, forcing the prisoners to shield their weakened eyes. As they slowly adjusted to this new light, several figures entered the room and came to a halt just within the entryway. The younger son of the ailing King of Calahorn stood foremost of four figures, his broad face relaxed and his lips pursed. His eyes alone betrayed the hatred that burned within, and there was a maddened, almost desperate way that they moved from one captive to the next as he clenched his hands tightly behind him. He was clearly Balinor's brother, possessing the same facial construction, the same wide mouth and prominent nose, and the same big, rugged build. Next to him stood a man that even the elven brothers recognized instantly, though they had never met him. He was the mystic Stenman, a gaunt, slightly stooped figure, lean and sharp in his features, and clothed in reddish robes and trappings. His eyes were strangely shadowed, reflecting an indisguisable evil in the man who had gained the complete confidence of the new, self-proclaimed king. His hands moved over his body nervously, raising almost mechanically from time to time to stroke the small, pointed black beard that shaded the angular face. Behind him stood two armed guards dressed in black and bearing the insignia of the falcon. Beyond them, just outside the doorway, stood two more. All held wicked-looking pikes. For a moment, no one spoke. No one even moved as the two parties scrutinized each other in the torch-lit gloom of the little cell. Then Palance made a quick motion toward the open door. "I will speak with my brother alone. Take these other two out." The guards silently complied, leading the reluctant elven brothers from the room. The tall prince waited until they had left, then turned questioningly to the scarlet-robed figure still at his side. "I thought that perhaps you might have need of me." The lean, calculating face stared steadily at the impassive Balinor. "Leave us, Stenman. I will speak with my brother alone." His tone of voice bordered on anger, and the mystic nodded obediently, quickly backing out of the cell. The heavy door closed with an ominous thud, leaving the two brothers alone in a silence broken only by the hissing of the torch flame as it consumed the dry wood and flashed into gleaming sparks. Balinor did not move, but stood waiting expectantly, his eyes trying to probe his brother's young face, trying to reach the old feelings of love and friendship they had shared as children. But they were missing, or at least carefully submerged in some dark corner of the heart, and in their place was a strange, restless anger that seemed to rise as much from dissatisfaction with the situation as from dislike of the captive brother. An instant later, the fury and the contempt were gone, replaced by a calm detachment that Balinor found both irrational and false, as if Palance were playing a role without any real understanding of the character. "Why did you come back, Balinor?" The words came out slowly, sadly. "Why did you do it?" The tall borderman did not reply, unable to comprehend this sudden change of mood. Before, his brother had been willing to have him torn to pieces in order to learn the whereabouts of the beautiful Shirl Ravenlock, yet now he seemed to have completely dismissed the matter from his mind. "No matter. No matter, I suppose." The reply came before Balinor had recovered from his astonishment at the abrupt change. "You could have stayed away after your treachery. I hoped you would, you know. Because we were so close as children, and you are, after all, my only brother. I will be king of Callahorn. I should have been firstborn anyway." He trailed off into a whisper, his mind suddenly lost in some unspoken thought. He had gone mad, Balinor thought in desperation, and could no longer be reached. "Palance, listen to me. Just listen to me. I have done nothing to you or to Shirl. I've been in Paranor since I left here weeks before, and I returned only to warn our people that the Skull King has assembled an army of such awesome proportions that it will sweep through the entire Southland unchallenged unless we stop it here. For the sake of all these people, please listen to me." His brother's voice pierced the air in shrill command. "I will hear no more of this foolish talk of invasion. My scouts have checked the country's borders and report no enemy armies anywhere. Besides, no enemy would dare to attack Callahorn, to attack me. Our people are safe here. What do I care for the rest of the Southland? What do I owe them? They have always left us to fight alone, to guard these borderlands alone. I owe them nothing. He took a step toward Balinor and pointed menacingly at him, the strange hatred flaming anew as the young face contorted savagely.
"You turned against me, brother, when you knew that I was to be king. You tried to poison me as you poisoned my father. You wanted me as sick and helpless as he is now, dying alone, forgotten, alone. You thought you had found an ally that could gain the throne for you when you left with that traitor Alanon. How I hate that man. No, not a man, but an evil thing. He must be destroyed, but you will remain in this cell, alone and forgotten, Balinor, until you die. The fate you had planned for me."
He turned away suddenly, breaking his tirade off with a sharp laugh as he paced to the closed door. Balinor thought he was about to open it when the hulking youth paused and looked back at him. Slowly he came around, the eyes sad again.
"You could have stayed away from this land and been safe," he muttered, as if confused by this fact. "Stenman said you would come back even when I assured him you would not." "He was right again. He is always right. Why did you come back?"
Balinor thought quickly. He had to keep his brother's attention long enough to find out what had happened to his father and his friends.
I discovered I had been mistaken. That I was wrong, he answered slowly. I came home to see our father and to see you, Pounce.
Father.
The word came out like an unfamiliar name as the prince moved a step closer.
"He is beyond our help, lying like one already dead in that room in the south wing. Stenman looks after him, as I do. But nothing can be done. He does not seem to want to live."
"But what is wrong with him?" Balinor's impatience burst free, and he moved toward the other threateningly.
"Keep your distance, Balinor."
Palance backed away hastily, drawing a long dagger and holding it protectively before him. Balinor hesitated a moment. It would be easy to seize the dagger, hold the prince captive until he was released. Yet something restrained him, something deep inside that warned against such a move. Quickly he stopped, holding up his hands and backing away to the far wall.
"You must remember, you are my prisoner."
Palance nodded in satisfaction, his voice unsteady.
"You poisoned the king, and you tried to poison me. I could have put you to death. Stenman advised me to have you executed immediately, but I am not the coward that he is. I was a commander in the Border Legion, too, before. But they are gone now, disbanded and sent home to their families. My reign shall be a time of peace."
"You don't understand that, Balinor, do you?" The borderman shook his head negatively, desperately trying to hold his brother's attention for a few minutes longer. Palance had apparently gone mad, whether from a latent congenital defect of the mind or from the strain of whatever it was that had been happening since Balinor had left Tirsis with Alanon. It was impossible to tell. In any event, he was no longer the brother that Balinor had grown to manhood with and had loved as he had loved no one else. It was a stranger living in the physical shell that was his brother's body, a stranger obsessed with the need to be king of Callahorn. Stenman was behind this. Balinor knew it. The mystic had somehow twisted the mind of his maddened brother, bending it to his own uses, filling it with promises of his destiny as king. Palance had always wanted to rule Callahorn. Even when Balinor had left the city, he knew Palance felt certain he would one day be king. Stenman had been there all the time, counseling and advising in the manner of a close friend, poisoning his mind against his brother. But Palance had been strong-willed and independent, a sane and healthy man who would not be broken easily. Yet he was changed. Hendel had been wrong about Palance, but apparently Balinor had been wrong as well. Neither could have foreseen this, and now it was too late. Shuro. What of Shuro? The tall borderman asked quickly. Again the anger faded from his brother's darting eyes, and a slow smile crept over his lips, relaxing the anguished face for an instant.
She is so beautiful. So beautiful.
He sighed foolishly, the dagger falling harmlessly to the cell floor as the prince opened his hands to emphasize the feeling.
You took her from me, Balinor. Tried to keep her from me.
But she is safe now. She was saved by a Southlander.
A prince like myself. No. I am king of Tirsis now, and he is only a prince.
It's just a little kingdom.
I had never heard of it myself. He and I will be good friends, Balinor. The way you and I once were. But Stenman says I can trust no one. I even had to lock away Messaline and Acton. They came to me when the Border Legion was sent home, trying to persuade me to, well, I guess to give up my plans for peace. They didn't understand. Why?
He stopped suddenly, his lowered eyes falling on the momentarily forgotten dagger. He picked it up quickly, placing it back in its belted sheath with a sly smile at his brother, looking strikingly like a clever child that had just avoided a scolding. There was no longer any doubt in Balinor's mind that his brother was totally incapable of making rational decisions. He was suddenly struck with his earlier premonition that while he could easily seize the dagger and hold his brother prisoner, it would be a serious mistake. Now he knew why that innate sense of warning had been generated. Stenman fully realized Palance's condition and had purposely left the brothers alone in that cell. If Balinor had attempted to disarm Palance and to escape while holding him prisoner, the evil mystic could have accomplished his obvious goal in one bold stroke by killing both brothers. Who would question him when he explained that Palance had met his death by accident while his brother was attempting to flee his prison confinement? With both brothers dead and their father incapable of governing, the mystic might be able to seize control of the government of Callahorn. Then he alone would determine the fate of the Southland.
Palance, listen to me, I beg of you, Balinor pleaded quietly. We were so close once. We were more than just brothers by bloodline. We were friends, companions. We trusted each other, loved each other, and we could always work our problems out by understanding each other. You can't have forgotten all that. Listen to me. Even a king must try to understand his people, even when they don't agree on the way things are to be handled. You agree with that, don't you?
Palance nodded soberly, the eyes vacant and detached as he tried to fight the haze that blocked his thought processes. There was a glimmer of understanding, and Balinor was determined to reach the memory that lay locked somewhere deep within.
Stenman is using you. He is an evil man.
His brother started abruptly, taking a step backward as if to avoid hearing more.
You've got to understand, Palance. I am not your enemy, nor am I the enemy of this country. I did not poison our father. I did not harm Cheryl in any way. I only want to help.
His plea was suddenly cut short as the ponderous cell door swung open with a sharp rasp, and the angular features of the wily Stenman appeared. Bowing condescendingly, he entered the cell, his cruel eyes fastened intently on Balinor.
I thought I heard you call me, my king, he smiled quickly.
You've been in here alone so long I thought something might have happened. Palance stared at him uncomprehendingly for a moment, then shook his head negatively and turned to leave. In that instant Balinor considered leaping upon the evil mystic and crushing the life from him before the absent guards could act. But he hesitated for that single brief moment, uncertain that even this would save him or aid his brother, and so the opportunity was lost. The guards came back into the cell, leading the elven brothers who looked about dubiously, then rejoined their comrade on the far side of the little room. Suddenly Balinor recalled something Palance had said when he was talking about Shirl. He had mentioned a prince from a tiny Southland kingdom. A prince who had rescued the young girl. Minyan Lee. How could he be in Callahorn? The guards were turning to leave now, and with them the silent Palance and his evil consort, a red-clad arm guiding the mindless prince from the room. Then abruptly, the lean figure turned to look once more on the three captives, a thin smile spreading over the pursed lips as the bowed head cocked carefully to one side.
In the event my king should have failed to mention it, Balinor.
The words sounded with a slow, burning hatred.
The guards at the outer wall saw you speaking with a certain Captain Shelon, formerly of the Border Legion. He was trying to speak with others about your predicament when he was seized and imprisoned. I don't believe he will have much chance to cause us any further trouble. The matter is quite ended now, and within time even you will be forgotten.
Balinor's heart sank suddenly at this final piece of news. If Shelon had been seized and confined before he had been able to reach Jinison and Fandwick, then there would be no one to assemble the Border Legion and no one to appeal to the people on his behalf. His absent companions would not know of his imprisonment upon reaching Tirsus, and even if they suspected what had happened, what hope would they have of ever finding out what had become of him? This lower level of the ancient palace was unknown to all but a very few, and its entrance was well concealed. The three despondent captives watched in bitter silence as the guards placed a small tray of bread and a jug of water just inside the open door, then moved back into the hallway, carrying with them all of the burning torches but one. The grimly smiling Stenman held this last light, as he waited for the stooped form of Palance to follow the burly guards. But Palance paused uncertainly, unable to take his eyes from his brother's proud, resigned face. The faint torchlight illuminated the broad features in reddish streaks, and the long, deep-rutted scar emerged dark and cruel in the half-shadow. The brothers faced each other in silence for several long moments, and then Palance started back toward Balinor with slow, measured steps, shaking off Stenman's hand as it tried to restrain him. He came to a halt only inches away from his brother, the dazed, searching eyes still fastened on that granite-hewn countenance as if trying to absorb from it the determination mirrored there. An uncertain hand raised itself quickly, pausing for an instant, then resting firmly on Balinor's shoulder, the fingers gripping tightly.
I want to know.
The words were a whisper in the near darkness.
I want to understand. You must help me.
Balinor nodded silently, his own great hand reaching up to take his brother's in a brief clasp of love. For a moment they remained locked together as if the friendship and love of childhood had never faded. Then Palance turned away and moved quickly out of the cell, hastily followed by a disturbed Stenman. The heavy door closed with the grating of iron fastenings and metal clasps, shutting in the three friends and the impenetrable darkness once more. The departing footsteps died slowly into silence. The waiting began anew, but any real hope of rescue seemed irretrievably lost. A shadowy form detached itself from the blackness of the night-shrouded trees in the deserted park beneath the high span of the Sendic Bridge and darted silently toward the palace of the Buchanas. In quick, sure-footed leaps, the powerful, compact form cleared the low hedges and shrubs, weaving between the stately elms, a pair of watchful eyes studying the wall enclosing the royal grounds, searching carefully for any sign of the night watch. Near the iron-wrought gates above the park, where the bridge opened onto the high ground, several guards patrolled, the falcon insignia visible in the torchlight of the gate entrance. Slowly the dark form climbed the gently sloping embankment toward the moss and ivy-covered walls above. Upon gaining the higher ground, it melted instantly into the shadows of the stone. For long moments, it remained completely invisible as it moved steadily away from the main gate and the feeble torchlight. Then the intruder was visible once more, a dark blur against the faintly moonlit west wall, as strong arms clung tenaciously to the sturdy vines, pulling the bulky form silently to the rim of the stone. There the head raised itself cautiously, and the keen eyes peered down into the empty palace gardens, making certain there were no guards close at hand. With a mighty heave of the powerful shoulders, the intruder gained the lip of the wall and, springing lightly over, landed with a soft thud amid the garden flowers. Running in a half-crouch, the mysterious figure sprinted for the shadowy cover of a huge spreading willow. Pausing breathlessly within the giant tree's protective limbs, the intruder heard the approaching sound of voices. Listening carefully for a few moments, he concluded it was nothing more than the idle conversation of several palace guards making their appointed rounds. He waited confidently, his compact frame blending so closely with the squat trunk of the tree that he was totally invisible from more than a few feet away. The guards appeared seconds later, still conversing in relaxed voices as they passed through the silent gardens and were gone. Resting furtively for a few minutes longer, the stranger studied the dark bulk that occupied the center of these tree-shaded gardens, the tall, ancient palace of the Kings of Calahorn. A few lighted windows broke the misty blackness of the massive stone structure, casting bright streamers into the deserted gardens. There were faint, distant voices within, but their owners remained anonymous. In a quick dash, the intruder crossed to the shadows of the building, pausing briefly beneath a small, darkened window in a recessed alcove. His strong hands worked frantically at the ancient catch, pushing at it and loosening the fastening. At last, with an audible snap that seemed to penetrate the entire palace grounds, the catch broke and the window swung silently inward. Without waiting to see if the patrolling guards had heard the sounds of his forced entry, the intruder slipped hastily through the small opening. As the window closed behind him, the faint light of a clouded moon caught for just an instant the broad, determined face of the redoubtable Hendel. Stenman had made one serious miscalculation when he had imprisoned Balinor and the cousins of Eventine. His original plan had been a simple one. The aged Shelon had been secured almost the moment after he left Balinor's side, preventing him from carrying out the prince's instructions for warning his friends of his own imprisonment. with Balinor and the elven brothers, his only companions when he had entered the city of Tirsis, safely locked away beneath the palace, and with the prince's close friends, Acton and Messaline, imprisoned as well. It seemed safe to assume that no one else in the city would cause any real difficulty. The word had already been spread that Balinor had come for a brief visit and gone on his way, returning to the company of the mystic Alanon, the man whom Stenman had convinced Palance Buckhanna and most of the people of Tirsis was an enemy and a threat to the land of Calahorn. Should any other friends of Balinor's appear and question the story of the borderman's abrupt departure, they would come first to the palace to speak with his brother, now the king, and it would be a simple matter to have them quietly disposed of. Undoubtedly this would have been exactly the situation with just about anyone except Hendel. But the taciturn dwarf was already familiar with Stenman's treacherous ways, and suspected that he had gained an unshakable hold over the disturbed Palance. Hendel knew better than to reveal his presence before finding out what had actually happened to his missing companions. It was a peculiar turn of events that brought him back to Tirsis. When he left Balinor and the elven brothers near the woodlands north of the fortress, he fully intended to travel straight to the western city of Varfleet, and from there proceed back to Cullhaven. Once in his own land, he would assist in mobilizing the dwarf armies to defend the southern territories of the Anar against the expected invasion of the warlock lord. He traveled all night through the forests north of Varfleet, and by morning entered the city, where he immediately called on old friends, and after a brief greeting, went directly to sleep. It was afternoon by the time he was awakened, and after washing and eating, he prepared to depart for his homeland. He had not yet reached the gates of the city when a ragged band of dwarfs staggered through the streets and demanded to be taken before the council. Hendel hurried along with them, questioning one he recognized as they were escorted to the council chambers. To his dismay, he learned that a massive force of trolls and gnomes was marching directly for the city of Varfleet from out of the dragon's teeth and would strike within the next day or two. The dwarfs were part of a patrol that had spotted the huge army and tried to slip past it to warn the Southlanders. Unfortunately, they were seen and most were killed in a pitched battle. Only this small handful had managed to reach the unsuspecting city. Hendel knew that if an armed force were moving toward Varfleet, there was, in all probability, a second, much larger force moving against Tirsis. He was certain that the Spirit Lord planned to destroy the cities of Calahorn quickly and thoroughly, leaving the gateway to all the Southland open and undefended. His first duty was to warn his own people, but it was a long, 2-day march to Cullhaven and 2 more days back again. He quickly discovered that Balinor had been mistaken in his belief that his father was still the king. If Balinor were killed or imprisoned by his insanely jealous brother or the treacherous mystic Stenman before he could secure the throne and gain command of the Border Legion, then Calahorn was doomed. Someone had to reach the borderman before it was too late. There was nobody available for the job but Hendel. Alanon was still searching the Northland for the missing Shay, accompanied by Flick and Menyon Lee. He made his decision quickly, ordering one of the battered dwarfs in the ragged patrol to leave that very night for Cullhaven. Whatever else happened, word would have to be brought to the dwarf elders that the invasion of the Southland had begun through Calahorn and that the dwarf armies must march to the aid of Varfleet. The cities of Calahorn must not fall or the lands would be divided, and the very thing Alanon feared most would come to pass. With the Southland conquered, the dwarf armies and the elven armies would be divided, and the warlock lord would be assured his eventual victory over all the lands. The ragged dwarf gave his solemn promise to Hendel that he would not fail, that they would all leave at once for the Anar. It took Hendel many hours to get back to Tirsus, since this time travel was slow and dangerous. The forests had been penetrated by gnome hunters whose mission it was to prevent any communication between the cities of Callahorn. More than once, Hendel was forced to hide himself until a large patrol had passed, and time and again he was compelled to go far out of his way to avoid crossing heavily guarded sentry lines. The network of sentry posts was far tighter than it had been in the Dragon's Teeth, an indication to the seasoned border fighter that the attack was close at hand. If the Northlanders planned to strike Varfleet within the next day or so, then Tirsus would be assaulted at the same time. The smaller island city of Kern might have already fallen. It was daylight when the dwarf succeeded in penetrating the last of the sentry lines and was approaching the plains above Tirsus, the danger of detection by the gnomes behind and the threat of discovery by the evil Stenmen and the misguided Palance just ahead. He had met Palance several times, but it was unlikely the prince would remember him, and he had encountered Stenmen only once. Nevertheless, it would be wise to avoid attracting anyone's attention. He entered the waking city of Tirsus, concealed in the midst of dozens of traders and travelers. Once within the great outer wall, he wandered for several hours through the nearly deserted barracks of the Border Legion, speaking with the soldiers there and searching for some clue concerning his friends. Finally, he was able to learn that they had arrived in the city at sunset 2 days ago and gone directly to the palace. They had not been seen again, but there was good reason to believe that Balinor had visited briefly with his father and then left. Hendel knew what this meant, and for the remainder of the daylight hours he posted himself close to the palace grounds, watching for any sign of his missing friends. He noticed that the palace was well guarded by soldiers wearing the crest of a falcon, a sign he didn't recognize. There were soldiers stationed at the main gates and throughout the city, all bearing the same insignia, and these were apparently the only activated units in all of Tirsus. Even if he found Balinor alive and managed to free him, it would not be a simple task to regain control of the city and reactivate the Border Legion. The dwarf heard no mention of the invasion from the north, and it appeared the people were totally ignorant of the danger facing them. It was incredible to Hendel that even someone as disturbed and misguided as Palance Buckhanna would refuse to prepare the city against a threat as awesome as that posed by the warlock lord. If Tirsus fell, the younger son of Rule Buckhanna would have no throne left him. Hendel silently studied the terrain composing the People's Park that stretched beneath the wide span of the Bridge of Sendik. When it was dark, he began his assault on the guarded palace. Now he paused momentarily within the darkened room, closing the window tightly behind him. He was in a small study, the walls lined with shelves of books carefully marked and labeled. It was the personal library of the Buckhanna family, a luxury in these times when so few books were written and dissemination was considerably limited. The Great Wars had nearly obliterated literature from the face of the earth, and little had been written in the embattled, desperate years since. To have a private library and to be able to sit and read any of the several hundred books at leisure were privileges shared by very few, even in the most enlightened societies of the Four Lands. But Hendel scarcely gave the room more than a passing thought as he moved on cat-like feet for the door at the far end, his keen eyes detecting a dim light along the crack near the floor. Cautiously, the dwarf peered into the lighted hallway. There was no one in sight, but he suddenly realized that he had not yet decided what his next step would be. Balinor and the Elven brothers could be anywhere in the palace. After rapid consideration of the alternatives, he concluded that they would be imprisoned in the cellar beneath the palace if they were alive. He would search there first. Listening for a long moment to the silence, the dwarf took a deep breath and stepped calmly into the hallway. Hendel was familiar with the palace, having visited Balinor on more than one occasion. He did not recall where specific rooms were situated, but he knew the halls and stairways, and he had been taken to the cellar where the wines and food were stored. At the end of the hall, he turned left at the cross passage, certain the cellar stairs were just ahead. He reached the massive door that shut out the chill of the lower passages when he heard voices in the hall behind him. Hastily, he tugged at the door, but to his dismay, it would not open. He pulled again with his powerful shoulders hunched down and knotted, and still the door did not move. The voices were almost on top of him now, and in desperation he moved to reach another place of concealment. At that instant his eyes fell on a safety catch close to the floor which he had missed. With the voices just beyond the corner of the hall and the footsteps of several men echoing on the polished stone flooring, the dwarf coolly drew back this second latch, swung open the heavy door, and darted inside. The door closed behind him just as three sentries rounded the corner on their way to relieve the guards stationed at the south gate. Hendel did not wait to find out whether he had been seen, but darted down the stone-hewn stairs into the blackness of the deserted storage cellar. Pausing at the bottom of the stairway, the dwarf groped along the cold stone of the wall for an iron torch rack. After several long minutes, he found it, resting the torch quickly from its setting and lighting it with the aid of flint and iron. Then, with slow, painstaking care, he searched the entire cellar, room by room, corner to corner. Time passed quickly, and still he found nothing. At last he had searched everywhere without any success, and it began to appear his friends were not being held captive in that part of the palace. Reluctantly, Hendel forced himself to admit that they might have been imprisoned in one of the upper rooms. It seemed strange that either Palance or his evil advisor would risk having the captives seen by people visiting. Still, Hendel considered, perhaps Balinor had indeed left the city of Tirsus and gone in search of Alanon. But he knew that guess was wrong even before the thought was completed. Balinor was not the kind of man who would seek anyone's help with this kind of problem. He would face his brother, not run. Desperately, Hendel tried to imagine where the borderman and the brothers might have been secured, where in the ancient building prisoners could be safely concealed from everyone. The logical place was beneath the palace in the dark, windowless depths he had just... Suddenly, Hendel remembered that there were ancient dungeons that lay beneath even this cellar. Balinor had mentioned them in passing, remarking briefly on their history, noting that they had been abandoned and the entry sealed over. Excitedly, the dwarf peered around the shadowed chamber, trying to recall where the ancient passage had been built. He was certain that this was where his friends had been taken. It was the one place a man could be hidden and never found. Almost no one knew of its existence outside of the royal family and their close associates. It had been sealed over and forgotten for so many years that even the eldest citizens of Tirsus might not recall its existence. Ignoring the small adjoining rooms and passages, the determined Hendel carefully studied the walls and flooring of the central chamber, certain that it had been here he had viewed the sealed opening. If it had indeed been reopened, it should not be difficult to find. Yet he could see it nowhere. The walls appeared solid and the molding unbroken as he probed and tapped along the base. Once again his search proved fruitless, and once again he felt that he might have been mistaken. Despondently he collapsed against one of the wine casings resting in the center of the floor, his eyes scouring the walls desperately as he tried to remember. Time was running out for Hendel. If he did not escape before daylight, he would probably join his friends in captivity. He knew he was missing something, overlooking something that was so obvious it had managed to escape him. Cursing silently, he rose from the wine barrel and walked slowly about the large chamber, thinking, trying to recall. It was something about the walls. Something about the walls. Then he had it. The passageway was not through the walls, but through the center of the floor. Suppressing a wild shout of glee, the dwarf rushed over to the wine casings against which he had twice that evening so casually rested. Straining his powerful muscles to almost superhuman limits, he managed to roll aside several of the unwieldy barrels so that the stone slab which covered the hidden entryway was revealed. Grasping an iron ring hinged at one end of the slab, the sweating dwarf pulled upward with an audible groan. Slowly the stone, grating in protest, the giant slab swung upward and fell back heavily on the flooring. Hendel peered cautiously into the black hole before him, extending the feeble torchlight into the musty depths. There was an ancient stone stairway, wet and covered with a greenish moss, that disappeared into the blackness. Holding the light before him, the little man descended into the forgotten dungeon, silently praying that he was not making another mistake. Almost immediately he felt the biting chill of the stale, imprisoned air cutting through his clothing to cling maliciously to the warm skin beneath. The musty, barely breathable atmosphere caused him to wrinkle his nose in distaste and move down the steps more quickly. Such confining, tomb-like holes frightened him more than anything, and he began to question his wisdom in deciding to venture into the ancient prison. But if Balinor were truly a captive in this terrible place, the risk was worth taking. Hendel would not abandon his friends. He reached the bottom of the stairs and could see a single corridor leading directly ahead. As he moved slowly forward, trying to peer through the damp gloom that defied even the light of the slow-burning torch, he could make out iron doors cut into the solid stone of either wall at regular intervals. These ancient, rusted slabs of iron were windowless and fastened securely in place by huge metal clasps. This was a dungeon that would terrify any human being. A windowless, lightless row of cubicles where lives could be shuttered away and forgotten as surely as the dead. For untold years, the dwarves had lived like this following the devastating great wars in order to stay alive and had emerged half-blind into a nearly forgotten world of light. That terrible memory had embedded itself in generations of dwarves, leaving them with an instinctive fear of unlighted, confined places that they would never completely overcome. Hendel felt it now, as nagging and hateful as the clammy chill of the earth's depths into which this ancient grave had been carved. Forcing down the rising knot of terror that hung in his throat, the determined hunter studied the first several doors. The bolts were still rusted in place and the metal covered with layers of dust and unbroken cobwebs. As he passed slowly down the line of grim iron portals, he could see that none of them had been opened in many years. He lost count of the number of doors he checked, and the dim corridor seemed to continue on endlessly into the blackness. He was tempted to call out, but the sound might carry back through the open entryway to the chambers above. Glancing apprehensively behind him, he realized that he could no longer see the opening or the stairs. The darkness looked exactly the same behind as it did ahead. Gritting his teeth and muttering softly to himself to bolster his waning confidence, he moved forward, carefully scrutinizing each door he passed for signs of recent use. Then, to his astonishment, he heard the vague whisper of human voices through the heavy silence. Freezing into a motionless statue, he listened intently, afraid that his senses were deceiving him. Yet there they were again, faint, but clearly human. Moving ahead quickly, the dwarf tried to follow the sound. But as suddenly as they had appeared, the voices were gone. Desperately, Hendel glanced at the doors to either side. One was rusted shut, but the other bore fresh scratches in the metal, and the dust and cobwebs had been brushed away. The latch was oiled and had been recently used. With one quick tug, the dwarf pulled back the metal fastening and yanked open the massive door, thrusting the torch before him, the light falling sharply on three astonished, half-blinded figures who rose hesitantly to face this new intruder. There were warm cries of recognition, a rushing together with outstretched hands, and the four friends were reunited. The rough visage of Balinor, towering above the drawn faces of the smiling elven brothers, appeared relaxed and confident, and only the blue eyes betrayed the borderman's deep sense of relief. Once again, the resourceful dwarf had saved their lives. But this was no time for words or feelings, and Hendel quickly motioned them back down the darkened passage toward the stairway leading up from this frightening dungeon. If daybreak found them still wandering beneath the palace, the chance of discovery and recapture would be a near certainty. They had to escape immediately into the city. In hurried steps, they moved down the corridor, the dying torchlight held before them like the probing cane of a blind man seeking the way. Then came the sudden grating of stone on stone, and a heavy thudding noise as if a tomb had closed. Horrified, Hendel charged ahead, reaching the damp stone steps and stopping short. Above, the huge stone slab had been closed, the fastenings secured, and the exit to freedom barred. The dwarf stood helplessly beside his three friends, shaking his head in stunned disbelief. His attempt to save them had failed. He had only succeeded in becoming a captive himself. The torch in his gnarled hand was almost burned out. Soon they would be left in total blackness, and the waiting would begin again. Chapter 26
"Junk! Nothing but junk!" roared Panamon Creel in frustration, kicking once more the pile of worthless metal blades and jewelry that lay on the ground before him. "How could I have been such a fool? I should have seen it right away!"
Shay walked silently to the north end of the clearing, his eyes staring at the faint trail in the forest earth that the crafty Oral Fane had left in his flight northward. He had been so close. He had held the precious sword in his own hands, only to lose it through an unforgivable failure to recognize the truth. The massive form of Kel'Thuzet loomed silently beside him, the great bulk bending close to the damp, leaf-strewn ground, the inscrutable face almost next to his own as the strangely gentle eyes studied and searched. Shay turned quietly back to the raging Panamon.
"It wasn't your fault. You had no reason to suspect the truth," he muttered dejectedly. "I should have listened to his raving with a little more wisdom and a little less... whatever. I knew the signs to look for, and I forgot to keep my eyes open when it counted."
Panamon nodded and shrugged, stroking the carefully trimmed mustaches with the point of his piked hand. With a last kick at the discarded implements, he called once to Kel'Thuzet, and without further discussion the two began quickly to break camp, strapping together the gear and weapons that had been deposited for the night. Shay watched them for a moment, still unable to accept his failure to gain possession of the sword. Panamon called gruffly to him to lend a hand, and he silently obeyed. He could not face the inevitable aftermath of this most recent setback. Panamon Creel had obviously been pushed as far as he would stand it, chaperoning a foolish and amazingly stupid little veilman around in the dangerous borderlands of Perrinor, searching for some people who might very well turn out to be enemies, and for a sword that only Shay knew anything about, but couldn't recognize it when he had it in his own hands. The Scarlet Highwayman and his giant companion had nearly lost their lives once already over this mysterious sword, and undoubtedly once was more than enough. The Veilman had no choice now except to try to locate his friends. But when he did find them, he would have to confront Al-Anon and tell him how he had failed. Failed them all. He shuddered at the prospect of facing the grim druid, of feeling those remorseless eyes peer into his most carefully hidden thoughts for the whole truth. It was not going to be pleasant. He recalled suddenly the strange prophecy related to them in the Valley of Shale on that dark, misted dawn over a week ago. It was the Shade of Bremen who had forewarned of the danger in the forbidding dragon's teeth, how one would not see Perenor, how one would not reach the other side of the mountain, yet would be the first to lay hands on the Sword of Shannara. It had all been foretold, but Shay had forgotten it in the stress and excitement of the past few days. The weary Veilman closed his eyes against the world for a few moments and wondered how on earth he could possibly be a part of this incredible puzzle that centered around a war of power with the spirit world and a legendary sword. He felt so small and helpless that it seemed that the easiest path for him to choose now was to bury himself and pray for a quick end to life. So much depended on him, if Al-Anon were to be believed, and from the beginning he had been completely inadequate to the task. He had been unable to do anything for himself, depending on the strength of other men to get him this far. How much had they all sacrificed for him so that he might lay hands on the magic sword? Yet when he had it in his grasp, I've decided. We're going after him. Panamon Creel's deep voice cut through the quiet of the little clearing like the sharp crack of an iron blade through dry wood. Shay stared at the broad, unsmiling face in astonishment.
You mean, into the Northland?
A scarlet thief shot him one of those angry looks that dismissed the Veilman as an idiot incapable of understanding sane men. He made a fool out of me. I'd rather cut my own throat than let the little rat get away from me now. When I get my hands on him this time, I'll leave him for the worms to chew on. The handsome face was emotionless, but there was undisguisable hatred in the menacing tone of voice that cut through to the bone. This was the other side of Panamon, the cold professional who had ruthlessly destroyed an entire encampment of gnomes and later stood in battle against the incomparable power of the Skullbearer. He wasn't doing this for Shay or even to gain possession of the Sword of Shannara. This was strictly a matter of his injured pride and desire for revenge on the unfortunate creature who had dared to bruise it. Shay glanced quickly at the motionless Kel'Thuzet, but the giant rock troll gave no indication of either approval or disapproval. The bark-like face was blank, the deep-set eyes expressionless. Panamon laughed sharply, taking a few quick strides toward the hesitant Veilman.
Think on this, Shay. Our gnome friend has made matters so much more simple by revealing the exact location of the sword you've been searching so long to find. Now you don't have to search for it. We know where it is.
Shay nodded in silent agreement, still wary of the adventurer's true motives.
Do we have a chance of catching up with him?
That's more like it. That's the spirit we need.
Panamon grinned at him, his face a mask of confidence.
Of course we can catch up with him. It's merely a matter of time. The difficulty will be if someone else catches up with him first.
Kel'Thuzet knows the Northland as well as anyone alive. The gnome will not be able to hide from us. He will have to run, run, and keep running, because he has no one to turn to, not even his own people. It's impossible to know exactly how he stumbled onto the sword, or even how he surmised its value, but I do know I was not mistaken about his being a deserter and a scavenger.
He could have been a member of the band of gnomes transporting the sword to the Warlock Lord. Or perhaps even a prisoner, Shay suggested thoughtfully.
More probably the latter, the other agreed, hesitating as if trying to recall something, staring northward into the gray mistiness of the forest morning. The sun had already cleared the horizon of the eastern edge of the world, its fresh light bright and warm, seeping slowly into the darkened corners of the forest land. But the mist of early morning had not yet cleared, leaving the three companions shrouded in a hazy mixture of sunlight and dying night. The sky to the north appeared unaccountably dark and forbidding even for early morning, causing the normally verbose Panamon to stare wordlessly at this curious blackness for several long minutes. Finally, he turned back to them, his face clouded with doubt.
"Something strange is going on to the north. Kelset, let's move out now. Find that gnome before he has a chance to stumble onto a patrol of hunters. I don't want to share his final moments in this world with anyone."
The giant rock troll moved into the lead in quick, easy strides, his head lowered slightly as he searched the ground before him, picking out the signs left by the fleeing Oral Fane. Panamon and Shay followed close behind in silent concentration. The trail of their quarry was readily apparent to the keen eyes of Kelset. He turned back to them and made a short signal with one hand, which Panamon translated for the curious Shay to mean that the gnome was running hard and fast, not bothering to hide his footsteps, and had evidently decided on his eventual destination. Shay began to speculate in his own mind where the wily little fellow would run. With the sword in his possession, he might be able to redeem himself in the eyes of his own people by turning it over to them for presentation to the warlock lord. But Oral Fane had appeared highly irrational in his behavior while he was their prisoner, and Shay felt certain that the gnome had not been faking. He had rambled on as if the victim of a madness he could only partially control, speaking in garbled sentences that had, in a jumbled fashion, revealed the truth concerning the whereabouts of the sword. If Shay had thought the matter through a little more carefully, he would have seen it. He would have known that Oral Fane had the coveted talisman with him. No. The gnome had crossed the mental barrier between sanity and madness, and his actions would not be entirely predictable. He would run from them. But to whom would he run? "I remember now," Panamon broke into his thoughts as they continued to make their way back toward the plains of Strelaheim. "That winged creature insisted that we had possession of the sword when it confronted us yesterday. It kept telling us that it could sense the presence of the sword. And so it could, because Oral Fane was concealed in the brush with the weapon hidden in his sack." Shay nodded quietly, recalling the incident bitterly. The skull-bearer had unwittingly tipped them off that the precious sword was in the area, but they had failed to notice this important clue in the heat and fury of their battle to survive. Panamon continued to ramble on in barely concealed fury, threatening to dispose of Oral Fane when they caught up with him in a number of extremely unpleasant ways. Then abruptly the fringes of the forest broke away, opening into the vast expanse of the plains of Strelaheim. In astonishment, the three halted together, their disbelieving eyes fixed on the awesome spectacle that loomed directly to the north. A huge, unbroken wall of blackness, towering skyward until it vanished into the infinity of space, stretching along the horizon to encircle the entire Northland. It was as if the Skull King had bound the ancient land in the shroud of darkness that lay upon the spirit world. It was more than the blackness of a clouded night. It was a heavy mistiness that rolled and swirled in deepening shades of gray as it ran northward toward the heart of the Skull Kingdom. It was the most terrifying sight that Shay had ever witnessed. His initial fear was heightened twice over by a sudden, unexplainable certainty in his mind that this huge wall was crawling slowly southward, blanketing the entire world. It meant that the warlock lord was coming.
"What in heaven's name is that?"
Panamon trailed off into stunned silence. Shay shook his head absently. There could be no answer to that question.
This was something beyond the understanding of mortal men. The three stood looking at the massive wall for several long moments, as if waiting for something more to happen. Finally, Kel'Thuzet stooped to peer carefully at the hard grassland before them, moving forward several yards at a time until he was some distance away. Then he rose and pointed directly into the center of the ominous black haze. Panamon started, his face frozen. "The gnome is running directly into that stuff," he muttered angrily. "If we do not catch him before he reaches it, the darkness will hide his trail completely. We will have lost him." Several miles ahead, on the graying fringes of the blackened wall of mist and haze, the small, bent form of Orlfane hesitated momentarily in its exhausting flight as the greenish eyes peered fearfully, uncomprehendingly, into the swirling darkness. The gnome had been moving northward since his escape from the three strangers during the early hours of the morning, running while his strength held out, then pushing forward in a shuffling trot, always with one eye straying back, waiting for the inevitable pursuit. His mind no longer functioned in a rational manner. For several weeks he had lived on instinct and luck, preying off the dead, avoiding the living. He could not force himself to think of anything beyond survival, a gut instinct to live another day among those who did not want him, would not accept him as one of their own. Even his own people had turned him away, scorning him as a creature lower than the insects that crawled the earth at their feet. It was a savage land that surrounded him, a land in which one could not survive alone for very long. Yet he was alone, and the mind that had once been sane had slowly turned inward on itself, shutting away the fears that were embedded there until madness began to take hold, and all reason began to die. Yet the inevitable death did not come easily, as fate intervened with twisted humor and favored the outcast with a final glimmer of false hope, placing in his hands the means by which to regain the seemingly unattainable warmth of human companionship once more. While still a scavenger, still fighting a losing battle to stay alive, the desperate gnome had learned of the presence of the legendary Sword of Shannara, its awesome secret gasped in faint warning from the rigid lips of one dying on the Strelaheim Plains, the blinded eyes failing as the life thread snapped. Then the sword was in his grasp, the key to power over mortal men in the hands of Orlfane. But the madness lingered, the fears and doubts wrenching ceaselessly at his failing reason as he pondered a course of action. This fatal hesitation resulted in the gnome's capture and the loss of the coveted sword, the lifeline back to his own kind. Reason gave way to despair and raving, and the already badly unbalanced mind collapsed. There was room now for only one burning, haunting thought. The sword must be his, or his life was over. He boasted irrationally to his unsuspecting captors that the sword was his, that only he knew where it could be found, unwittingly betraying his last chance to keep possession. But the strangers failed to read between the lines, dismissing him too hastily as merely crazed. Then came the escape, the seizure of the sword, and the flight northward. He paused now, staring blankly at the mysterious wall of blackness that barred his way northward. "Yes, northward, northward," he mused, smiling crookedly, the eyes widening madly. There lay safety and redemption for an outcast. Deep within, he could feel an almost uncanny desire to run back the way he had come. But the thought remained locked inescapably in his mind that his salvation lay in the Northland alone. It was there that he would find the Master, the Warlock Lord.
His gaze dropped momentarily to the ancient blade strapped tightly to his waist, its length dragging clumsily in the dirt behind him. The gnarled yellow hands strayed briefly down over the carved handle, touching the engraved hand raised high with burning torch, the gilt paint already flecking off in chips to reveal the burnished hilt beneath. He clutched the handle tightly, as if trying to draw his own strength from its sturdy grip. Fools. Fools all that had not treated him with the respect he should command. For he was the bearer of the sword, the keeper of the greatest legend their world had ever known, and it would be he who would... He shut out the thought hastily, fearful that even the void about him could read his mind, peer into his secret thoughts, and steal them away. Ahead, the frightening darkness waited for him to enter. Orlfane was afraid of this, as he was of everything else, but there was no other way to go. Dimly he recalled those who followed. The giant troll, the man with one hand, whose hatred he instinctively sensed, and the youth who was half man, half elf. There was something the gnome could not explain about the latter, something that nagged with unshakable persistence at his already beleaguered mind. Shaking his rounded head blankly, the little man moved forward into the graying fringes of the dark wall, the air about him dead and silent. He did not look back until the blackness was all about him and the silence had disappeared in a sudden rush of wind and chilling moisture. When he did glance back briefly, he saw to his horror that there was nothing there. Nothing but the same blackness that lay all about in heavy, impenetrable layers. The wind began to rush violently as he moved on, and he became aware of other creatures in the darkness. They came first as a vague awareness in his mind, then as soft cries that seemed to seep through the haze and cling inquisitively about him. At last they appeared as living bodies, touching softly with cringing fingers the flesh of his person. He laughed in maddened frenzy, knowing somehow that he was no longer in a world of living creatures, but a world of death, where soulless beings wandered in hopeless search of escape from their eternal prison. He stumbled on amidst them, laughing, talking, even singing gaily, his mind no longer a part of his mortal being. All about him the creatures of the dark world followed in cringing companionship, knowing that the maddened mortal was almost one of them. It was all a matter of time. When the mortal life was gone, he would be as they were, lost forever. Orlfane would be with his own kind at last. Almost 2 hours passed, winding away with the slow, deliberate sweep of the morning sun, and the three pursuers stood on the fringes of the wall of mist into which their quarry had disappeared. They paused as he had done, silently studying the forbidding blackness that marked the threshold to the kingdom of the warlock lord. The haze seemed to lie upon the deadened earth in